Today our topic is bhakti. Bhakti means devotion. And devotion is nothing but a yoga of the heart. How we approach God through our heart, feelings, emotions, love, affections, and so on. Normally, it is a sublimation, the spiritual orientation of all the best of the human heart, the best of the human emotions and feelings, our affinity towards mother, father, relatives, all these higher emotions are sublimated to a spiritual level, and we direct those emotions towards God. This is the essence of bhakti or devotion. So one Sanskrit word for a bhakta or a devotee is a very interesting word, ajatashatru. What it means, a person who has no enemy. Literal meaning is somebody whose enemy is yet unborn and will not be born. That's a Sanskrit meaning of ajatashatru. So a true devotee of God is essentially a good human being. He is always friendly, kind and compassionate, not only towards other devotees, but towards all living beings. So kind of a higher universal spiritual humanism. That is the essence of bhakti in Vedanta tradition. Now, in one of our famous classical works on devotion, known as Bhagavata Purana, it contains 335 chapters. Classified into 12 sections. Each section is called as Skandha chapter, and then it contains 18,000 verses. It is a slightly complicated work from a grammatical standpoint. Now, that book outlines the way of approaching God. And here we have to remember that this book is a traditional work on devotion or devotional philosophy in Hindu tradition, but it is so universal in its approach to the idea of bhakti. So I will try to say a few things based on that text, quoting the text, of course, to do justice to this great work. So one important analysis of this devotional philosophy in the book is Sravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam Padasevanam Archanam Vandanam Dasyam Sakhyam Atmanivedanam Idi Pumsarpida Vishnoho Bhaktisce Navalakshana Kride Bhagavat Yadhva Tanmadhyaya Dhidumuttamam. So the meaning is this: Sravanam Kirtanam Smaranam Vandanam Archanam Dasyam Sakhyam Atmanivedanam. It's called Navadha Bhakti, ninefold path to devotion, to God, let us say. Now, a literal translation is this: the practice of devotion, for example, these following nine forms, hearing about God, singing about His greatness, remembering Him always, serving Him through consecrated images, holy pilgrimages, associating with holy men, worshipping Him in whatever way possible, practicing the attitude of a servant towards Him, cultivating loving intimacy with Him, and surrendering one's own life to Him. This is the definition of bhakti. Now one may wonder what this means. Let us say the first one, sravanam, smaranam, marchanam, vandhyam. Sravanam, hearing. Now, whatever we hear with our ears, we collect in our mental system. We cannot hear anything without some effect taking, some impact happening in our mind. For some mischievous person, you record some inauspicious sounds, words, which are maybe tabooed in Oxford Dictionary. You go on playing that every day to you. You find your mind getting polluted. So whatever we hear through associations will have a positive or negative effect on the mind. What it means is, listening to auspicious sounds, devotional music, or any kind of, music, art, reading books on holy saints and sages. That's kind of nutritious food to the mind, for the mind. You know, when we eat bad food, when we drink ditch water, when we eat unhygienic food, our body will fall sick, we will die. So also when we feed our mind with bad food, mind also will fall sick and will die. What it means is, if you feed your mind with good food, then mind becomes healthy, strong and vigorous. And what is the positive food for the mind? Good ideas, good thoughts, good emotions, good associations. These constitute good, nutritious, spiritual food for the mind. It's just like eating nutritious food for the body. We doctor will advise you so that you won't fall sick. Similarly, we should eat good mental food. And the most elementary or the grossest kind of good food for the mind is listening to good ideas. And that may include good music, good art, any of this. The sravana means hearing. And then you yourself repeat those words, engage in good conversations, because our thoughts and words are interconnected. We cannot go on speaking bad words without eventually polluting our mind. It is inevitable. Which means if we keep speaking good words, we are actually purifying our mind. That is like organic purified mineral water. For the mind is hearing good things, listening to good things. Another spiritual discipline mentioned in our ancient scriptures is smaranam. Smaranam actually means remembering. Now, what we remember is essentially what we have heard earlier, what we have experienced earlier, what we did. So, remembrance is nothing but mind going backward and reconnecting with what it has already become familiar with. That's what is called remembrance. Now, I cannot explain this better than by taking one interesting episode, which is in the form of a story, a parable from the same devotional book. There's a story, if those of you know Sanskrit and familiar with the text, Ajamila Vakhyanam, the story of Ajamila. Let's say Ajamila is the name of a person, let's say. A man, a young man, who had a good upbringing. He was born in a cultured family. He was brought up by very pious, God-fearing parents who taught him all virtues to be an ideal human being, a good human being. So he was a good son to his parents, a good brother to his sisters and brothers, a good neighbor to his neighbors. He was a good civilized citizen. And then what happened was, he fell into bad company, bad associations, and he eventually lost his track. He became a profligate. He became a curse to society, given to alcoholism, drug addiction, terrible things, which are certainly not good things. So he fell in bad ways. So remember, a man, a youngster who was born to pious parents, who had a good upbringing. Later on, when he get old, when he got old, he fell in bad ways. And then it was time for him to die. By the time he had squandered all his properties, he had become a bankrupt. He had lost everything, his character, his wealth, everything. Now, you know, here we can very well understand. Now, there is a mythology. So all these stories are designed to teach us some great messages. So the time came for him to die. So where in ancient mythologies, you know, two types of people will be interested in your soul when you die. The devil and also God. So he was living a very bad life, Ajamila. So naturally, devil means in Hindu tradition, not necessarily devil, Yama. Somebody will take him to hell. It's a mythology. But mythology has got a great message, practical application even to our own times, Smaranam. So they came to drag him to hell. He was crying and weeping. And he was frightened seeing these terrible forms, terrible creatures coming to drag him to hell. And in his anguish, in his fear, he was so scared. So he cried out a name. Incidentally, that was the name of his own son. So I told you earlier, he was born in a civilized family, he was brought up as a God-fearing person, later fell on bad ways and he lost his track, and eventually he became a curse to his own society. He ill-treated his own parents, drove them away from his home, became a curse to his own society. He became a profligate, became a moral wreck, so to speak. But when he was growing up, he also had a son. And the son's name was Narayana. So Narayana is one of the synonyms in Sanskrit. What it means is the Lord or the destination of all spiritual seekers. That's the literal meaning of Narayanam, Ayanam. Yes, it means Narayana. That's the literal meaning. It's a proper name in Sanskrit, but every Sanskrit word has its own etymological explanation based on the root from which that word comes. So the literal meaning or the etymological meaning of this word is the ultimate destination of all pious spiritual seekers. That's the name, meaning of Narayana. But that was also the name that he gave to his own son. Because he himself was a great devotee when he was younger, early days. So he had given the name of the Lord, which is one of the synonyms of the Lord in Hindu tradition, to his own son. So when he cried, when he became frightened seeing the agents of the Lord of Death dragging him to hell, he cried out of fear, and the name he cried out, he called, was calling his own son to come and protect him. But the name also was the holy name of God in Hindu tradition, Sanskrit name. So what happened? God came. God's agents came to rescue him. So eventually he was rescued from being dragged away to hell. He was sent to heaven to enjoy the close proximity with God. This is a story. Now, why I narrated this story? Smaranam. So as a young boy, he used to be asked to go to temple to do his spiritual practices, meditation, chanting this holy name. That was again Narayana, one of the synonyms of Vishnu in Hindu tradition. So when he called that name, not meaning God, but meaning his own son, out of fear, suddenly his mind went back to early days when as a little boy he was taking the holy name of Narayana. So you can imagine that means is, if you do any kind of spiritual practice with all sincerity, then that itself is a kind of spiritual bank balance. We are putting money in the bank. So when you get old, you can draw your check from a spiritual bank. That's the idea behind. So that is the power of smaranam. Memory is a very important instrument. It can be a great blessing, as it happened in the case of this gentleman. Because he had completely forgotten his spiritual life, had become a moral wreck, become a curse to society. Such a man, totally helpless, he called out his son, not God, but a name as a coincidence happened to be the same name that he used to chant as a young devotee, as a boy in younger days, as he was being brought up by his own parents. That is Sravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam. The three disciplines are mentioned here. Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasim, Sakhyam, Atma Nivedanam. Then, of course, any kind of humble service. In Hindu Vedantic tradition, any kind of act of compassion, of sympathy, of human emotions, any sublime activity, totally unselfish, with all compassion, with all kindness, done to anyone, even to the pets, if you are bringing up your pets properly, and you will be very cruel to your neighbors, there are two mutually contradictory characteristics. You are very compassionate to the pets and very cruel to neighbors. But the little compassion that you show to the pets will also be a spiritual bank balance. I mean, you'll be drawing a check and you'll be investing in the spiritual bank. The act of cruelty also will have a negative effect. Now, these ideas can be properly understood only when we keep in mind two fundamental doctrines in Vedanta. And one is the law of karma, the other is the doctrine of reincarnation. These two important principles should be kept in mind to fully understand the message of this parable. So whatever we do, it produces, our action produces twofold results. One result is very visible. You do something good for others, that person is benefited. Well, that's a good thing, act of charity. That is visible, explicit, obvious. Then there is another kind of result. When you do any act of compassion, love or kindness to anyone, even you plant a tree or sending a check to help people suffering from natural calamities in distant continents, all these become acts of compassion. So whatever we do, that produces one visible result, but the invisible result is very important because it is the real investment in the spiritual bank, because that will benefit us in our future evolution in spiritual life. The invisible result is carried over to the next life. When you are born again, you carry with you this baggage of good actions, which become good samskaras, good tendencies, good emotions, good habits and attitudes and aptitudes. You are born again with this bank balance. And on the strength of this previous life experiences and tendencies, you go forward. That's why no act of compassion will be lost, and you are never late. This is an important point to be kept in mind. So this Ajamila story which I narrated just now can be understood only in the light of this, because he did something that was good in his early life. It benefited him at the time of his death. We have to remember, it depends upon the kind of impressions we have deposited in our own mind. And then Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakhyam, Atma, Divedanam. And there are a few other disciplines. If you are a Christian, go to church, read and do some charity. You need not worry about any priest or anything. And Vedanta tells you, you can have a hotline to God. And there is no need of an intermediary. Intermediaries are meant to be trespassed and transcended in Vedantic tradition. That's why there is a very great statement in the most elaborate, the most the largest Hindu classical work like Mahabharata. This is a very important character. She's an old woman, Kunti. So I don't have to narrate the story. Mahabharata is a very interesting, very huge classic, full of different conflicting characters and scenes. But one character is Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas. She had only one prayer to God. And you know the prayer is, Vibhada Sandhuna Sashwat Yatra Yatra Jagat Prabhu Bhavadu Darsanam Yasyat Abhinav Bhava Darsanam. But it means Sanskrit, but explain this. Oh God, I have only one prayer. What is that prayer? Give me as many troubles as possible. Let there be no end to my troubles. Because if everything going on fine for me, then I may forget God. Then if I have money and nothing else to do, go to Hawaii and have a good time. That's what we do. So if you are troubled, then you pray to go to church or a temple. You start thinking of the darker side of human life, which we, if you can keep that in mind, it can give us a lot of level-headedness, spiritual level-headedness, what you call spiritual common sense. So that's why the extreme kind of example is the Kunti. She says, oh God, don't give me any good time. Give me plenty of troubles. We have the bad habit of forgetting you when I'm surrounded by all good things in life. So I should, in short, give me a few troubles once in a while so I can be reminded of God. That's a prayer. One of the greatest prayers in the entire Mahabharata. Now, this is one important thing. Now, another very interesting thing, I'm just giving some quotes from this ancient classic. Another very short, like a formula, Arakshidam Tishthati Daivarakshidam Surakshidam Deva Khadam Vinashyati. You know what it means? It's very interesting. Suppose, this is again a great principle in not only Hinduism, but also in some of the higher mystical teachings of Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, you find, says, even when you are protected by all people around you, even we are surrounded by all pleasant circumstances, everything going on fine for you, still if God doesn't want, it doesn't click. There is some kind of a problem and things don't just happen. And then on the other hand, suppose you are surrounded by all kinds of problems, all conceivable types of obstacles and difficulties. Still, if you are protected by God, then everything is fine. That's the literal meaning of this statement. Arakshidam tishthati daivarakshidam. Those who are protected by God, true devotees, they survive. Those who don't care for this, for God, but those who become overconfident of their own powers, their own resources, to solve their own problems, and they then at some point, as part of the evolution, if not in this life, next life, they will be put in a set of circumstances. But they have to remember, without God, everything else is void, is invalid. It doesn't function, it doesn't work. This is an important principle in Vedanta. So you can find this, this is a common principle not only in Hinduism, of course, it's written in so many hundreds of books. In ancient times, there are works on devotional philosophy in Hinduism going back to 3000 BC. But in some of the great writings of great mystics like Saint Teresa of Avila and autobiographical writings, or you find the Way of a Pilgrim, the great Russian mystical work, very short, in mid-19th century, or Philokalia, Saint Francis of Assisi, you find the writings of great mystics, you find, at some point, they are able to survive many difficulties, and you should remember that many of the mystics got only post-mortem recognition. When they were living, they had to face terrible tortures and torments, and they could survive because they had this strong faith. Because in most of the cases, the canonization took place only at least 200, 300 years, only 500 years after the death of the mystic who must have been tortured for decades. That's the story of many of the great mystics. Not all, but many. And they could survive these difficulties because they had a strong faith that this God is the ultimate protector. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is a very elaborate, a very graphic description of four levels of devotion. In a descending order, in the 12th chapter, it's called Bhakti Yoga, the chapter dealing with the devotional philosophy, the path of devotion, from 8th verse to 11th verse, in four verses, four levels of devotion, four different phases in the evolution of devotion are mentioned in a descending order, so to speak. So the first one, the most enlightened devotee of God, Mayyeva manadatsva mai buddhim nivesiya nivasyasyasi mayyeva adau udhanna samsaya. 8th verse of the 12th chapter. What it says is, the highest devotee is one. Again, this is the highest devotee. Is one who lives in God and in whose heart God has taken his residence. This is the language used here. Mentally and physically, your thoughts and emotions and feelings are centered around thought and contemplation on God. So God himself starts living in human heart. One of the verses in the Bhagavata Purana says, I don't live in the palaces, in the marble structures, or in the huge edifices, or beautiful, magnificent structures that people erect in my name. My favorable residential address is the heart of a devotee. Yoginam paramam guhya means hridayam. The word hridaya, literal English translation of the Sanskrit hridaya, means heart. The meaning is one's own being. So when you say I, you place your palm on your heart. You don't put on your head, I, you don't say. You say, I, like this, you say. So what's the problem with this heart and no difference? But somehow it's an automatic human gesture to identify his true identity with his heart. So in Sanskrit language, the word for heart is hridayam. So hridi ayam, that's the meaning. Hridi means at the center or being here. Here is our true presence of the divine. So in the Bhagavata Purana, it says, my favorable residence, the most magnificent temple, is in the pure heart of a true devotee and not marble structures. That's the literal meaning of this Bhagavata statement. The word used, yoginam hridayam mahya, means yoginam hridayam means, yogi here means bhakti yoga, devotees. Their heart is the place where I have my residential address, identity card, not in big structures. Structures are needed for human beings to gather, to congregate, to do music, to develop. Without the huge churches, there will be no great tradition in music in the Catholic Church. Without the huge temples or Buddhist structures in India or other countries, there will be no mythology, there will be no art forms, music. All these develop as part of different forms of people worshipping God. For that we need temples, we need churches, we need synagogues, we need all structures. But the real place where God lives is the heart of devotee. Now, that's why it is said the highest devotee is one who considers his heart as the real temple where God resides. Mayeva manath. May means in my own heart. Mayeva manathasva, my buddhi nivesya. My heart and my intellect, my thoughts and emotions merge with God. So my heart becomes the temple, the shrine, this idea behind. Now, this is the highest, the peak of spiritual evolution in devotional philosophy. Very difficult reach. But then if that's not possible, there is a next stage. Atha chittam samadhadum na shaknoshi mahi sthiram. Abhyasa yogena tato mami chaptam dhananjaya. Our heart becomes the shrine or the temple only when we focus our whole thoughts and emotions on God. Atha chittam samadhadum na shaknoshi. Suppose you cannot do that. Suppose you cannot direct our thoughts and emotions, functions of mind and intellect on God, then you can have different disciplines. You can try to practice different spiritual disciplines that may eventually help you to reach this highest stage. And that is called Abhyasa Yoga. That is we already discussed. That is Sravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Bada, Sevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakhyam, Atma, Nivedanam. Different phase. It includes many things, as I mentioned, listening to spiritual ideas or music or some connecting our mind with spiritual thoughts by hearing or by reciting or by remembering or by doing service to other devotees by charity, by acts of charity and compassion. And also by different rituals done with devotion, not mechanically. And then again, showing respect and obeisance to everyone. Or thinking of yourself as God's servant. Or thinking of yourself as God's friend. So, Dasyam, Sakhyam. These are two important methods mentioned here. You can find this in many other traditions also. In some traditions, they consider that you should think of yourself as the servant of God. And I think the other one, you should think of yourself as the friend of God, Sakhyam. That is special to Vedantic tradition. Then Atmanivedanam, that's highest. It literally means self-surrender. This self-surrender is supposed to be the highest stage. That's the ultimate. In the Gita, in the 18th chapter, 66th verse is Sarva dharman parityaja mamekam saranam praja aham tva sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ma suja. What it means is, suppose you want to live a spiritual life, but you when you try to read some book, any tradition, any sublime book, in whatever tradition you are born into, but mind doesn't permit you. You would rather read the latest San Francisco Chronicle instead of reading, let's say, Sermon on the Mount or Bhagavad Gita or something. Because mind's natural tendency is to read that. The more eye-catching. Because of the samskaras and tendencies we accumulate in the mental system, mind doesn't allow you to listen to higher ideas or to connect with higher ideas. We can connect with higher ideas only if our mind is ready. If our mind is on one level and spiritual ideas on another level, then they don't connect. That's why we find this conflict. If you ask this question, there's a mystery. You know, the vast majority of people in the world, they want to do something good and noble. Even the most materialistic person, somebody utilitarian person, somebody who doesn't care for anything except money and wealth and material things. Even he may, at some point, at least when there is a death of a near and dear ones, Or maybe the banks collapsing, losing $1 million. A billionaire also may pray to God in some cases, not always. It happened. It may not last for long. So there are moments in human life when we suddenly confront this problem. Well, things just don't add together. So I should turn to somebody else, some higher transcendental, some higher celestial being. So you go to a church or a temple or any place of worship or read, take a holy book, go to library, want to read something for peace of mind. But nearby, on the same table, you find some sensational, let's say somebody is playing the Terminator number 1, 2, 3. You rather close the Bible and listen to that. Because the mental emotions and feelings are more conducive to listen to those things, because more sensational, more eye-catching, more spectacular. Because the mind agrees with that, what is happening on the screen there. But mind is not in a position to enjoy and appreciate what is written in the Sermon on the Mount or in the Bhagavad Gita or any holy book. So this conflict happens. So at that time, devotional philosophers have one very interesting practical recommendation. If we cannot mentally, intellectually, emotionally connect with spiritual ideas, do something good. Well, if you can't listen to prayer, you can clean the steps of the temple or a church where people are walking up to the prayer hall. And you find if you do that for some months, eventually you won't feel the need to clean the steps. You walk straight to the prayer hall. Because any kind of physical activity without a selfish motive, without any benefit in return, that this wonderful effect of purifying our mind. I mentioned earlier, it is a small check you have put in the bank balance, our own spiritual bank. Some good karma, good activity, good thought, any noble activity, physical activity itself becomes a spiritual asset, a spiritual force in the form of some sublime thoughts and emotions. That's why frequently you find when all of us, even those who never do anything good for others, but if they happen to do something good, they feel a great joy. They don't tell others. And then they gradually develop a tendency to keep doing something good, because doing something good produces a positive effect for the mind. It is a good nutritious meal for the mind, good food for the mind, good spiritual food for the mind. Any noble act of charity, compassion, or selfless service. That's why you see in this story, Arjuna Dasim Sakhim Atma Nivedanam. Atma Nivedanam means self-surrender. It comes at the end of it. But once we start our education in the kindergarten, which is doing some little physical activity, some kind of selfless activity, some kind of act of compassion or kindness or humanism for others, that eventually slowly helps us to move forward in this spiritual evolution. Then eventually we'll reach a point when we will be able to keep our mind and thoughts and emotions on God. That is the mystery of this. You can find this in all traditions. And even it's a common knowledge, even when criminologists will agree with you, when you say even the most hardened criminal would rather have another way of life if given an option. Not all the death thought will go away again, he'll be back to his criminal activities. But then, at some point, the mind reasserts itself. Though it doesn't last for long for many people, if you can make it last long, then you are saved. That's why Lord Krishna says, if you cannot keep your mind on God, then some kind of discipline, practices, selfless activity, act of charity, compassion, all will help you to eventually reach that point. The third stage is Suppose you cannot even do that, mind just doesn't allow you to do anything unselfish. Cutthroat utilitarian. You want full return for every dollar you had deposited. Otherwise, you do nothing. So, such people cannot practice Abhyasa Yoga. Abhyasa Yoga Asamarthosi. Asamartha means incapable of doing this Abhyasa Yoga. Incapable of doing these spiritual disciplines, practicing spiritual disciplines. Madathamavi karmani kurvan siddhim avapchasi. Then you do whatever you are doing. Don't give a thought to God by doing. But after you have done your duty, after everything is over, when mind agitates, when mind again becomes anxious and worried about what will happen, did my work go well? Suppose you have lost your job, looking for a new job. Are things going to happen properly? So mind becomes anxious. So do your best. And then, well, I have done my best in the name of God. So somehow, if you can bring the spiritual connection into every kind of material activity, into every kind of secular activity, you can bring God into your computer room, your office place, by walking the streets, your driver, you're driving, you can bring. So God is not sitting in a structure and he cannot get out. So you have to go there to see him. That God, I don't have a very great respect for such a God. On the one hand, you say God is omnipresent, all-pervading, all kind, all compassionate, almighty, omnipotent. And then you say, I should perform this particular ritual in this specified manner, then God will be very happy. The slightest departure in detail, he will be terribly angry. Such a God is no better than many of our politicians, actually. That's why Hinduism, the highest God is a compassionate person who understands human predicaments, his weaknesses, and willing to help you. And this is not a mid-19th century grammar school headmaster sitting in his classroom with a big stick in his hand. Absolutely not. That's a very important point. In fact, our idea of God is very important in devotional philosophy. What image comes to our mind when we think of God? Some big muscular male dominating, all dominant person sitting above the clouds with a book in his hands, do's and don'ts, watching, looking for some minor defects on our life, and absolutely no compromise. He won't take no for an answer. Such a God we don't need, actually. But on the other hand, suppose there is a God who is a God of everyone. He's a God of not only believers, also non-believers. After all, when you divide humanity into believers and non-believers, it is we do, God doesn't do. So the highest idea of God is the embodiment of all compassion, all understanding, all broad-mindedness. Very flexible, very compromising, absolutely no fanaticism. Not only that, if you worship the same God in a slightly different manner, he's not looking for problems. You'll be okay, that is your tendency. That's why in Gita I say, Ye yathamam prabaddhinte tam sadaiva bhajamyaham mama varma anuvartante manushyaha partha sarvashaham. Many of you may not know, that was a central theme of Swami Vivekananda when he introduced Vedanta in the first Parliament of Religion, 1893. This is what actually captivated the late 19th century Americans who were so much advanced, maybe much more than our own times, in terms of spiritual inclinations, thanks to the great work of the three transcendentalists, Emerson, Turner, and Whitman. The great transcendentalist Emerson, Toron Whitman. And Emerson's Brahma is nothing but an English rendering of four lines, actually four verses, four couplets, from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Emerson was a great mystic, so also Toro and Whitman. So when Vivekananda came, he's the founder of the organization that we belong to, When he came to America in 1893 and gave his first talk as a representative of Hinduism, the central theme of his talk, which lasted maybe around 6 minutes or 7 minutes maximum, or maybe less, the central theme of his talk was something very interesting. And you can imagine 6,000 Americans standing up with ovation, and he became a celebrity with one single speech. You know what he spoke about? He said, whatever may be the path you are following, whatever be the tradition, the rituals, the way you are practicing your devotion, I will accept you in that respect, in that way. When your mind is pure, when your feelings are pure, then when you worship God, whom you believe in your own way, according to your own tradition, if your mind is pure, if your actions are pure, I will accept, I will listen to your prayers and be fulfilled. That's the interpretation of this. I won't ask you, no, you pray, you should change the prayer slightly. It's not Latin, it is English, it won't work. It's not Sanskrit, so it won't work. God will not say that. Because your ritual is different. You're worshipping the way, the God in whom you believe, in your own way, depending upon the tradition you're born into, the language you're born into, the culture you're born into. Accordingly, you form your own idea of God and you pray with all pure heart to that God. That God will listen to you. That's the God we are talking about here. This is a very, very important principle to remember. Because a true devotee thinks of God as the God of everyone, not only those who believe in him, but even of those who don't believe in him. That's why, you know, I often quote this very, one of the most powerful statements from Vivekananda, through 10 volumes, maybe this, and this is on this context. He says, you live your life in such a way that God will accept you even if you don't accept him. What does it mean? Suppose there is somebody in your neighborhood who doesn't go to any place of worship, temple or church, or doesn't read any book, or Bible or Bhagavad Gita, Dharmapada. He doesn't read. But he's a good neighbor, good human being, living a good life, very compassionate. He's a spiritual person. He's a devotee of God. He may not recognize even God's existence. He may be an agnostic. But if he's a great humanist, then he's a devotee of God. That's why the spiritual humanism is the most integral part of devotional philosophy in Hinduism. And so I have already outlined in a descending order the highest, given in the eighth verse of the 12th chapter of the Gita, and then 9th verse, and then 10th verse, then 11th, in descending order, last, the most elementary, the kindergarten level of devotion. He says, Edadabhi asaktosi kartum adyogamasidaha sarva karma pharatyagam tadakkuri idatmavan. Suppose, as mentioned in the 10th verse, you do your work, you think of your work as God's work. Suppose you cannot do that, no problem. You do your duty in whatever way possible. But for finishing that, after completing your duty, you just mentally, you leave to God. If you do that, what happens is slowly you start climbing up the steps because you already entered the kindergarten and you won't stop before you reach Harvard or Oxford. That's the idea behind. So, Hinduism gives a vast umbrella of different levels of spiritual evolution, different levels of devotional philosophy and devotional practices. So within a very short time, I was only trying to give a short bird view of this great teaching. And maybe on another occasion, I may elaborate on this further. Thank you. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.